Last year, Adam and I and a few hundred friends of DeSoto gathered in the Masonic Lodge inside a cemetery in the heart of Hollywood. Were we there to practice some dark rite? Some sinister ritual designed to bring deceased Star Trek actors back to the plane of the living? To bring an unholy horde of undead nerd celebrities to Earth to consume the brains of the living? No, we were just doing our live show of the Share Your Embarrassment Tour. It's our review of Star Trek V, and we filmed it. We just wanted to let you know to get ready for that live stream announcement coming next week. If you're a Max Fun member and you support our shows, you'll get access to discounted tickets from membership at MaximumFun.org. So, good time to make sure those emails are delivering properly to your inbox. Either way, we'll be announcing ticket links soon here and on our mailing list that you can sign up for at podshop.biz. The Share Your Embarrassment Tour is coming to your living room for one last stop, and you're not going to want to miss it.
Captain?
Not here.
Captain?
Report.
Signatures detected.
Shields up.
Signatures detected.
Red alert.
Context Starfleet Command.
What's happened?
Context Starfleet Command.
Delay that order.
Context Starfleet Command.
This is the captain.
Context Starfleet Command.
Get out of my chair. Chair.
We have engaged the Klingons.
Klingons.
Welcome to the Greatest Discovery, a Star Trek Discovery podcast from the makers of The Greatest Generation. I'm Ben Harrison.
I'm Adam Pranica.
Adam, we haven't really discussed what, if any, we're going to do with the beginning of these episodes. Do you just want to jump right in? I just feel like The Greatest Discovery could be a little bit more efficient of a show and less masturbatory.
Well, I was thinking one thing we could talk about is a very big decision that the makers of Star Trek Discovery made. They have a post-Discovery show, Ben, and in spite of the heroic efforts of the Greatest Generation viewership, we were not the hosts of it.
Weren't even asked.
So a tip of the cap to whoever those people are. Good luck out there with that live show broadcasting from inside the pocket of the Roddenberry Industrial Complex.
You know, like, I make the joke that we weren't even asked, but I don't know that I would have wanted to be asked. I mean, when we were getting ready to do this show and we talked it over with MaximumFun.org, there were some suggestion from the folks that do ad sales that maybe we seek sponsorship from CBS, and we were both like, I don't know about that. I would much rather make all the fun of this show if that's what needs to happen. And I cannot imagine I didn't watch that after show, but I cannot imagine that they have anything but the lightest of critiques if they ever speak critically of the program.
Oh, sure. Like the only reason I wanted to be asked was so I could turn it down. Like, that would have been, that would have been amazing. Why don't we drop right into the second half of this cliffhanger during what could be the beginning of a hot war? It's season 1, episode 2, Battle at the Binary Stars.
We have engaged the Klingons.
Klingons? Klingons? Those are Klingons?
What the hell is going on this ship?
I haven't the slightest idea.
So this episode really, I mean, it picks up exactly where the previous one left off. Riker is on the bridge. Locutus is on the view screen. He's given the order to fire.
A Shelby is recoiling in horror.
But yeah, like you saw this as a stitched together one thing, not a two-parter. This moment played for some suspense as I like scrambled to learn how to use the new CBS app.
Yeah, I mean, it played for great suspense. Great suspense in the way that great suspense in TV and film is often depicted. It's the conflict between two people while the rest of the world burns around them. Like, it isn't just a conflict between them. It's everything else happening in this scene. Everything is on the line.
But then we cut to a 7 years earlier scene.
What we get in the flashback is the scene of Michael meeting Captain Georgiou. She beams on board with Sarek. Sarek makes the introduction. Sarek in this scene being far more hospitable than Michael. Michael's a real jerk.
Yeah, she's trying to, like, out-Vulcan Sarek.
Yeah.
And Sarek is like, listen, we're around humans. Like, you don't have to... You don't have to do that.
Like the
that's
person
not impressing
that,
these people.
Like the person that comes back from vacation with like, I just got back from Japan and now all we're going to eat is Japanese food.
She is not a Starfleet at this point, Michael Burnham. And I sort of wondered, does Sarek have the power to blow in a call and say like, hey, my little buddy here, why don't you give her a couple of pips and, I don't know, let's call her a Lieutenant Commander.
Yeah, it's unclear, like, the degree to which this is an official exchange program thing. It does not appear as though the Vulcans are getting an exchange student on their end. This is just sort of a drop-off at school. Sarek has pulled the van up to the curb, kicked Michael right. out, and have a great first day.
Yeah, like, is this how Michael came to live aboard the Shenzhou? Like, how did she then become a Starfleet?
I mean, if, you know, in the way that pilot episodes and early episodes teach us about the structure of the show, this may be a show that is told in flashback in the way that we've seen it.
I'm curious to see how the mechanics of that worked, because she comes aboard and Lieutenant Saru is already the science officer of the Shenzhou, so presumably she got kissed into Starfleet and advanced past him within the intervening 7 years?
That would explain the antagonism in the pilot episode.
Well, here's the deal. Our messianic evil Klingon, T'Kuvma, is like getting the heads of the 24 great Klingon houses together. Unclear if Moog is among them, but these are this is a pretty like... It kind of has the same vibes as that part of the Lord of the Rings trilogy where they meet the ghost army. They're doing the Klingons have the same like hologram technology, but they use it in a much grander way. The people you're talking to are like giant in the bridge. But T'Kuvma is trying to kind of rally these guys to his cause, and he's saying, hey, listen, like we've got 24 warring houses, and we're living in a galaxy that is full of other aliens, and they're gonna come, you know, fuck with us. He's got like essentially a cult going where the central premise is Klingons first, you know, make Kronos great again, and we got to get the 24 houses united so that we can start kicking ass again. And the phrase "we come in peace" is his most hated phrase. He's warning these like ghost hologram Klingons that's what the Federation is going to say when they show up. And there's not like universal agreement here. There's like one strong voice in the anti-T'Kuvma camp, and then everybody else is like, all right, let's hear this guy out.
It's weird for someone who is all about like purity of race or whatever, like there are clearly very different looking Klingons from all these houses.
Yeah, and I wondered if that was because of the holograms on the Klingon ship look a little bit night vision-y.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. There sure is a variety of loafishness on all of these guys. And the one girl. She's got like a meatloaf necklace up there.
Like T'Kuvma has this shit timed up. Like he has a Swiss watch of a plan here because he knows exactly when all of Starfleet is going to show up.
It's unclear how he knows this.
A convenient thing that he knows but just happens.
A good way to ensure that will happen is having an armada join you in this corner of space and just sort of drumming your fingers while the Shenzhou decides what to do.
Yeah, it's in many ways kind of a perfect combination of Hunt for Red October and Crimson Tide, because it's like full-blown Crimson Tide on the Shenzhou, but then the Admiral comes on the hologram on the Klingon ship and is like Secretary of State to the Russian ambassador in Red October, saying, don't you see that our ships being nose to nose in this part of space is inherently dangerous.
Every time they cut to the exterior, it is like 200 Klingon ships of varying shapes and sizes and the tiny Shenzhou.
Yeah, the Federation ships that show up are all kind of on the same rough design as the Shenzhou. Like, nobody's got a much bigger saucer section than the Shenzhou. So the main Klingon ship, the huge one that T'Kuvma is in command of, by far bigger than all of the others, but a couple of orders of magnitude bigger than any of the Federation ships. And yeah, like the Admiral says his thing about we come in peace, and it's on.
Yeah, it's weird how that statement.
Or no, the Admiral doesn't say it. It's the Captain, right?
Yeah,
it's Captain Georgiou.
Yeah, she uses the same HoloLens technology to speak to the Klingons.
Yeah, it's a lot less green when she does it.
As soon as she drops that line, "I come in peace," this really gooses everyone in the room. T'Kuvma just explodes at this. Like, now is the time to fuck them up. Fuck you and your come in peace. Light them up. And immediately the Federation is overmatched.
That's a pretty good space battle. Like it's fun to see the like wide angle as all the phasers start going. And yeah, like the Shenzhou is getting torn apart basically right off the bat.
What?
What's happening?
What's
all this?
I'm trying to save you.
What is this?
Michael Burnham, our main character, has not had much to do so far in this episode. Like, we've seen her getting sent to the brig, and we've seen the, you know, 7 years ago, but she's sitting in the brig for all of this fun and games. And as the ships, like, you know, fire upon each other and tear each other apart, she finds herself in the brig with like a huge hole in the hull, and the only thing keeping her breathing is the like energy field that they use in lieu of jail bars.
I love the idea of how many sides? 1, 2, 3, 4 of 5 sides of her jail cell being basically exposed to space. She plays the demo version of chess that you get on a computer and totally owns the computer into letting her out of her cell.
I guess the computer's like default ethical functions are that you can let somebody out of a cell on voice command if it's going to save their life, but she has to kind of convince it that this is a life-threatening situation.
Yeah, by describing what's going to happen. It's almost as if the computer cannot, like the computer can only take things at face value. It cannot predict things that are about to happen. So what Michael does is explain, well, what happens when I run out of air? The computer's like, well, you're going to die. And then she says,
then ethically, you should open the door for me.
Working. Request confirmed.
And she sort of uses the logic of that as, well, if your chances are zero of remaining in the brig, and they're slightly greater than zero by zooming across the vacuum of space, like, shouldn't that be what the computer's ethical standard is? Like, give me a chance to live. And sure as shit, she convinces the computer to let her out.
A little bit before that happens, there's a pretty interesting scene that I don't want to miss talking about with you, Adam, which is like the ops guy gets the classic, like, he's sitting at his control station and it explode.
Right.
All of the control stations on all starships are loaded with explosives and will go off if you get hit by enemy fire. And he's like this actor is no bueno, but, you know, the character comes down and is confused and is under the impression that he has walked himself to Six Bay. And Michael is there in her cell, and she does, it's kind of a little bit of a redemptive moment for her character, that she's not like trying to take advantage of this guy that is clearly, you know, confused and out of sorts. She's just, you know, thinking about him, caring for him, and getting him where he needs to go. It's a little bit of a save the cat. And then, you know, the ship takes another hit and that guy is like ejected into space. And that's when she has her like psychic conversation with Sarek, which is this is a little bit of a, like, we are expanding the continuity of what Vulcans are capable of. W/R/T mind melds.
You know what this made me think of is that if Sarek melded with Michael and Sarek melded with Picard, then there's a little bit of Michael in Picard too after that, right?
Not a bad point. Anyways, the conversation she has with Sarek is basically like, you've done well, but like you need to recognize that you still have a role to play. You've got to get out of this jail cell and find a way to help this situation, because right now it's not looking great for the Federation and the ship and all of your friends. Like, you gotta get at it. And that's how she decides to trick the computer, play a little ethics chess with her. Did you read the thing about how Majel Barrett's voice was going to be on Discovery?
I did not.
The thing I read was that they had, like, recorded all of this, like, scratch audio of Majel Barrett, like, reading different stuff so that they would have all of the, like phonemes that they would need mm-hmm. to rebuild her voice to use it as the computer forever.
Mm-hmm.
Like, before she died, they, like, made a point of getting this in case they needed her for Star Trek computers. And this is not Majel Barrett's voice on this ship, and I'm wondering, does the Shenzhou, like, predate Majel Barrett's voice, but the, like, USS Discovery will have her voice as the computer?
Yeah, you know, they keep referring to the Shenzhou as an old ship. I mean, maybe that's all for a reason. Maybe that's to place it in a specific moment in time that will not be our time for the show.
This episode moves so much faster than the first one.
Yeah, I mean, there's nothing like a firefight for speeding up the passage of time.
The Klingons leave the Federation in really bad shape. Like, basically the entire fleet that shows up gets ripped up, and the Admiral's ship, the Europa, shows up and talks to the Klingons. And this is like the person of status that T'Kuvma has been waiting to talk to.
Like, he is the last best hope to stop this thing. Because there's no reason for us to think that the Federation has a chance in a hot war with the Klingons right now.
Yeah. And so, you know, he's doing that, I'm a well-intentioned human talking to a Klingon and hoping we're building some consensus upon which a diplomatic agreement can be founded. And as he's doing that, T'Kuvma plows a cloaked ship into the bow of the Europa. And it's like, I don't even know what this ship was. Like, it was kind of hard to tell from the way it was shot and the way it was depicted. It kind of looked like it was just like a boat because it had like the prow of a ship. It was like a knife in space.
T'Kuvma, what you don't see in that scene is like him making the jerk off motion while the Admiral is talking to him. Like, he could not be respecting this guy's message anymore.
And the Admiral's ship, the Europa, like sets self-destruct and takes out that ship.
It's a pretty great scene when this ship decloaks basically inside the Europa, seeing that hull fold up like carpet, really. Like,
yeah,
it really gets fucked up. And this Admiral, who we're taught to hate for the last hour, does a thing that is really noble and heroic. He blows up his own warp core and really cripples the ship that killed him.
It's the first time we've seen setting self-destruct to take out Klingons work since the third Star Trek film, I guess.
Right.
We have engaged the Klingons.
Klingons? Klingons? Those are Klingons?
What the hell is going on this ship?
I have no idea.
What is this?
The rest of the episode, Adam, is kind of mop-up, I feel like. You know, Michael has gotten out and to a great extent has taken advantage of the fact that they are in such dire straits to get the captain listening to her again. She basically did the baddest thing that she could possibly do, but because the Shenzhou is like in such bad shape, she can talk Giorgio into a course of action.
You know, hearing you describe this part of the episode makes me think about how we're really seeing two sides of the same kind of story. T'Kuvma is trying to convince a group of people who may not believe him that his way is the way to go, in the same way that Michael is on board the Shenzhou. They're both trying to make the case for their positions, and they're having varying degrees of success in doing so. They're both suffering some losses here. I would argue that the Federation far greater than the Klingons.
You know, the Klingons that have died doing what they love. And so...
you can't say the same for the Federation at this point.
No. And so Takuvma's like, this is great. We got... There's Klingon bodies all over this system. We're gonna put them in sarcophaguses and staple them to our fender. And I'll do it by hand myself, each one of them. I guess they're using like a tractor beam to suck these Klingon bodies toward their ship. And Michael gets the idea to use the warhead from a photon torpedo and like beam it into the chest of one of these Klingon bodies. And they use it to break the neck of Takuvma's ship. It like the bridge command section breaks off from the drive section. And then Michael and Captain Georgiou, just the two of them, beam over to take Takuvma hostage because the broken neck part, right?
Like the part that's spinning.
Yeah, the command section. Yeah. If Takuvma is a prisoner, then his argument doesn't hold as much weight. Like he is a pathetic symbol of failure rather than a martyr or a monster. And it's a little unclear to me why they didn't just get the toughest seven people on the ship or however many spots they have on the transporter pad.
Yeah, this was crazy.
Not a good plan.
Maybe this was the mission that henceforth made it so that the captain and the first officer didn't go on away missions together. It's the Georgiou rule. We get a really fun, protracted amount of Star Trek fighting here. There is not a closed two-handed punch to be found.
Yeah, I was a little sad not to see the closed two-handed punch.
Sure.
I feel like that is something that really puts us in universe. But they beam aboard, they like take out a bunch of Klingons with their handguns, and it winds up being Michael fighting Vok and Captain Georgiou fighting Takuvma, and it does not go great for Takuvma or Captain Georgiou, does it?
No, I mean, it really pays off the whole and special guest star Michelle Yeoh.
Yeah.
Like, I wish we hadn't gotten a credit sequence in either of these episodes because
it you know whenever spoils it.
Yeah, whenever you see and featuring or and a special guest star, like, you know they're not long for this television world.
Yeah.
In the way that I think she was sold to us as a major and feature character throughout the season.
Right. And like what you want is it to be you want it to be the surprise that Drew Barrymore buying it at the beginning of Scream is, you know? Like, I thought she was going to be the fucking star of this show.
Yeah, yeah.
And like, you know, going into this, I thought that, and then the second you see the credit sequence, it's like, oh.
Yeah.
I saw footage of Michelle Yeoh at the red carpet, like, or some event for this, where there were, like, three young Asian women dressed up in Captain Georgiou costumes that were like losing their shit, so excited to meet her. And the second she died, I just thought about those young women, and I was like, God, like that has got to be a real kick in the teeth.
We have been waiting for someone worthy of our attention.
Hey, when you listen to podcasts, it really just comes down to whether or not you like the sound of everyone's voices. My voice is one of the sounds you'll hear on the podcast Dr. Game Show, and this is the voice of co-host and fearless leader Joe Firestone.
This is a podcast where we play games submitted by listeners, and we play them with callers over Zoom we've never spoken to in our lives. So that is basically the concept of the show. Pretty chill.
So take it or leave it, bucko. And here's what some of the listeners have to say.
It's funny, wholesome, and it never fails to make me smile.
I just started listening and I'm already binging it. I haven't laughed this hard in ages. I wish I'd discovered it sooner.
You can find Dr. Game Show on MaximumFun.org.
Video games can make you laugh.
They can make you cry.
They can even make you sing.
We're the hosts of Triple Click.
It's a podcast about video games.
This is an exciting time for new games, from Diablo to Final Fantasy.
From Starfield to Street Fighter.
From Zelda to, oh, who are we kidding? We're just going to talk about Zelda.
Whether you play games or you just like hearing about them, we've got you covered.
Find us at MaximumFun.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Bye.
The scene that follows this is a jump in time, Ben, and it is the scene of Michael's court-martial, a scene that takes place with her Federation administrators veiled almost completely in darkness. And me and Ben, the other Ben, talked about two scenes specifically as being a little incongruent, and the first was the scene in the sand drawing the symbol, and the second was this scene. With the administrators in shadow, my guess was that they're going to call the scene back later on and reveal these people in such a way that, that will make them characters later, characters of importance. But for right now, this is what we get. We get a backlit Michael just basically eating her shit and pleading guilty to her mutiny.
I was very relieved by this scene because, I mean, one thing we have talked about basically ad nauseum on our other show is how many court-martialable offenses
right.
go by without any seeming consequence. The last note I wrote after the first episode was, this first officer is fucking crazy.
Yeah, yeah.
And
crazier than you would expect a human raised on a Vulcan world to be.
Yeah, and I feel like while the scenario kind of bore her out in some ways, like the way she acted was bonkers, and she gets exactly what she deserves at the end of episode two.
Totally agree.
The only thing about it that doesn't make any sense in Star Trek is that they give her life in prison, which is like something that I would expect Klingons to give somebody. I would not expect like the United Federation of Planets to be handing out life sentences for this kind of thing. Like kicking out of Starfleet would make sense. Like life in prison seems not a very utopian idea, you know?
What really excited me at the end of the episode, and this is the end of the episode, her final moments of being tried and convicted of her crime, is that, holy shit, is this a prison show? Because then they show the previews for what's to come this season, and it's like prison ship action, a Michael in a Starfleet prison jumpsuit. Like the possibilities are really exciting to me in a way that made the first two episodes a total head fake for me. Like, what kind of show is this? I don't think we know yet.
I really, yeah, like, I mean, the other things.
And by that I mean, what genre is it?
That preview, we have some of the Rainn Wilson stuff, the Harry Mudd character, mm-hmm. and I mean, like, I feel like the way things are wrapped up with the Klingons is, like, Vok kind of takes over for, like takes up the crusade that T'Kuvma started, because mm-hmm. T'Kuvma dies with a hole in his chest, and like, you know, there's clearly like not universal agreement within the Klingon Empire. Like, this could totally just be a Star Trek show after this. It doesn't necessarily have to be just 1,000% Klingon human war,
right?
It doesn't have to be a prison break movie. It could be anything. It really, like, I can't think of another first episode of a television show like this where it's so much about one character.
It really may be. It's really doing that Star Trek is a place thing in my mind.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're moving the main character around to all these places. She's experiencing not just uniquely Federation things, but what it's like to live in this time kind of things. This time that includes a jail. This time that includes being punished for doing a terrible thing. And I think saying all of this is another way to say that I really like this episode because it is such a broad setup for what's to come.
It's broader at the end than I could have possibly imagined, even like 7/8 of the way through.
Yeah. Yeah, I feel like at the end of the first couple episodes of every other Star Trek series, you knew all the rules for the universe. You knew you could sort of sketch the boundaries of where they would go and what they would do. But like, I could not tell you what episode 3 is going to be or where it's going to take place. And I think that's really exciting. Did you like the episode, Ben?
I did. I think I like it a little bit more than episode 1. I would say that my like major fear at this point is like, I don't know we always agree on this, but I like those Star Trek episodes that are like multiverses. What could we do with that as a dramatic premise? You know, like I have a very hard time imagining that as being part of this series in a way that isn't obnoxious. Because right now, like, sort of what it is setting up as is this is a show with one character at its center. And if something like multiverses, what can we do with that happens to one character, it is very hard to like write a next episode where that doesn't matter that much.
Yeah, exactly.
So, you know, like I'm going into episode 3 with some misgivings, but generally speaking, I am really impressed with this as an opening gambit for a lot of reasons, both from the kind of like arts and technical execution side and also from a story side. But yeah, like there's so much about this that could go awesome and so much that could go terribly.
Michelle Yeoh is a great actor, and I hope she's still on the show in flashback form. She's a great actor generally. I'm not sure she's a great actor in this show. She doesn't have a lot to do, and what she's given, she can't really work with.
She has like one interesting captain moment, I feel like.
Yeah.
And yeah, that seemed like a bit of a missed opportunity.
Yeah, I'll definitely miss her if this is it for this character, because I think she's great.
Yeah, well, this show definitely is not going to be doing any flashbacks. That's not part of the you know, story structure of this show.
Yeah, this is very nonlinear, even by Star Trek standards. So it's another way that the possibilities are fairly unpredictable at this point. What do we have coming up on episode 3, Ben? Do we know, or are we not even doing that?
Well, we have a title. The episode 3 is called Context is for Kings, and that will be the next episode of The Greatest Discovery.
Always be context. A, always. B, B. C, context.
Context is for closers only.
We need those new episode leads, Ben. We're totally,
I can't do anything with these.
We're totally
these
Jack
leads.
Lemon over here on our fucking podcast. We got no screeners. We got no leads. We got
no gold watch.
We're doing this blind. We're like crying in a phone booth right now. This is terrible.
Yeah, we used to be a machine. We've really fallen on hard times. W/R/T leads.
Yeah, it's a real jalopy right now. This program is.
Well, Adam. That'll be the next episode. I'm really looking forward to it. And we're doing this show. We'll be coming out the Tuesday after airings of Star Trek Discovery going forward. We will be doing Priority One messages. If you're interested in that, go to MaximumFun.org/Jumbotron. And with that, we'll let Rob take it from here.
Thanks, Rob.
The Greatest Discovery is a MaximumFun.org podcast. Hosted by Adam Pranica and Benjamin R. Harrison. Produced and edited by Rob Schulte. Music by Adam Ragusea. You can find Adam Pranica on Twitter at @CutForTime, or you can find Benjamin Harrison on Twitter at @BenjaminAHR. Make sure to use the hashtag GreatestGen. You can continue the conversation over at the Facebook group and page, or at the GreatestGen subreddit.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.